Israel's brutal war on the people of Gaza and the support this war has received from governments around the world has once again confirmed that the modern Middle East is racked by the violence of imperialism. On a more positive note, a new generation of young people, particularly in the Western world, have been shaken up by Israel's actions and in the process have come to reject many of the Zionist myths that for too long have hidden Israel's crimes. For many, the oppression of the Palestinians seems so similar to other examples of injustice that they care about, such as the treatment of African Americans, anti-migrant racism, and the oppression of indigenous peoples around the world. And Israel is seen as another embodiment of white supremacy, colonialism, and racism, alongside, you know, Donald Trump, the police, Western corporations, and the far right. And this has given many the confidence to stridently reject the claims that criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic and that the conflict is, you know, simply too complicated to take aside. Many of the young left-wing people grappling with these issues have adopted a framework for understanding them that is heavily influenced by the politics of settler colonial theory. This theory argues that many of the examples of racism and oppression seen in the world today are the products of colonialism and often a particular form called settler colonialism. And this is often seen as a product of whiteness and of the inherent drive within Western culture to dominate other territories and peoples. And because of this, an anti-colonial struggle is needed that unites the indigenous population and their potential allies against the settler population in a battle for decolonization. And this is seen as a useful framework, not just for understanding the plight of the Palestinians, but for many other cases of oppression and racism. So the oppression of indigenous people here in Australia is said to be due to an ongoing process of colonization that benefits all of settler society. And racialized minorities, such as African Americans or Latino Americans, are theorized as internal colonies being exploited by the rest of the non-colonized population of the United States. For many, the politics of settler colonialism has been a starting point for rejecting the racist lies of capitalist society and supporting the struggles of the oppressed against this. And in this way, it's definitely a positive move away from some of the limitations of, you know, a liberal multicultural approach or a kind of moderate centrist approach with its emphasis on gradually reforming capitalism into a supposedly post-racial colorblind society. But you're probably not surprised to learn there's also significant problems with the politics of settler colonial theory, hence the talk today. Most importantly, I would argue it disconnects the issues of imperialism and racism from any serious understanding of class and capitalism. And this has important implications for developing the kinds of organizations and struggles that we need to successfully confront racism and oppression. So I'll start by talking about the problems that arise when applying the settler colonial framework to Indigenous oppression in Australia. But it has kind of similarities with other countries with minority Indigenous populations and in which the initial process of colonization has come to an end. In Australia, settler colonial theory was developed by an academic called Patrick Wolfe in the 1990s. But since then, it's become very popular, not just within academia, but progressive circles more generally. And many of its kind of core ideas form much of the common sense way that most left-wing people think about Indigenous issues. The main argument of Wolfe and other settler colonial theorists is that the key division in Australia is between settlers and Indigenous people, and that settler society as a whole, i.e. everyone who's not Indigenous, you know, migrants, workers who aren't Aboriginal and so forth, gain material privileges from the dispossession of the Aboriginal population. As Sarah Madsen explains in her book, The Colonial Fantasy, Why Australia Can't Solve Black Problems. I use the term settler and non-Indigenous in relation to any individual or group of people who came to Australia at any time since the first invasion 1788. The term settler is intended to be discomforting, deliberately underscoring the nature of non-Indigenous peoples' relation to this territory and its people as a further impetus towards decolonial transformation. Now, Madsen does acknowledge that the extent to which settlers benefit from colonization is modified to varying degrees by, you know, all sorts of other issues such as class and gender and sexuality, whether people are migrants or not, and so forth. However, she also claims that settlers are all complicit in sustaining colonial relationships and argues we are none of us outside or above these relationships. Migrants are still settlers, white progressives are still settlers. And this is an analysis shared by basically all left-wing writers in Australia on these issues, and around the world, in fact. So Sir Inglehart, whose book is down in the bookstore, who I've written about in a few different articles, is even more explicit. He argues that if working class settlers are exploited by the ruling classes, overthrowing the settler state would mean overthrowing a system in which they share, even if unequally, in the colonial loot. Key to settler colonial theory, then, is the argument that the non-Indigenous population is bound together in a common process of colonizing Indigenous people. And settler colonial theorists argue that anti-Aboriginal racism is the key way that the ruling class divide and rule society and neutralize challenges to its rule, and they argue that when these challenges emerge, they can be resolved by the ruling class giving non-Indigenous people more benefits at the expense of Indigenous people. And there's kind of different versions of this argument. The first version is that workers in countries like Australia, you know, aren't militant or socialist or revolutionary or whatever, because they're a privileged section of society benefiting from anti-Aboriginal racism. And there's a book from a couple of years ago by Lorenzo Veracini called The World Turned Inside Out, which makes this claim. In fact, he makes a claim about the whole world. That's why there hasn't been revolutions in Europe and America and so forth, is because of settler colonialism. I think this ignores a lot of things. In terms of Australia, it ignores the fact that there has been a very radical working class history. There's many sessions about that at this conference, you know, from the mass strikes of the 1890s, the general strike of 1917, to the post-war strikes and the struggles of the 60s and 70s. And it's true that none of these struggles ended in socialism, but it's also not the case that a divide and rule on the basis of pitching Indigenous people versus non-Indigenous people was the key way that these struggles are defeated. And in fact, it wasn't a very significant feature of any of them. I think it's important to understand, because on the surface, it can seem like a compelling argument, right? Like, a lot of us here, I'm sure, are socialists against capitalism. The system uses divide and rule in order to ensure its, you know, continued control of society, undoubtedly. But this has not been a key feature in terms of them using anti-Aboriginal racism to, like, stop revolutions from breaking out in Australian society. Yeah, that's just, like, historically the case. The other argument that's made that's kind of similar but distinct is that it's not really about revolution, but it's more that workers can't or are very unlikely to show solidarity and support for Indigenous people in their struggles because they benefit from anti-Aboriginal racism. Now, the problem of this is it doesn't square with the actual history of solidarity shown by the workers' movement and the socialist left with Aboriginal struggles. And this is something which, you know, discussed at length in the book that Naomi mentioned earlier. At first, this was led by a left-wing minority of activists, definitely. It wasn't that many people, mainly organised within the Communist Party of Australia, who waged a fight for unions to take up more radical positions on Aboriginal questions in the 1930s. However, by the 1950s, large sections of both the communist and even the non-communist trade union world supported campaigns against racist segregation and for civil rights for Aboriginal people that emerged in the post-war years in particular. And this campaigning led even the very moderate Australian Council of Trade Unions to adopt a position supporting the struggle for equal pay for Aboriginal people in 1967, followed by further resolutions supporting the struggle for land rights and opposition to black deaths in custody in the early 1970s. Some of the most famous examples of Aboriginal activism in Australia, such as the 1946 Pilbara strike, the 1966 Wave Hill walk-off, and the 1972 Aboriginal Tent Embassy protests, received significant levels of support from trade union organisations and rank-and-file workers. It's also notable that many, if not most, of the post-war Aboriginal activists had themselves been labour activists involved in trade union organising to some degree or another. Now, of course, there were some trade unions and sections of workers who, you know, were hostile towards Aboriginal people, had all sorts of racist ideas. Workers' consciousness is unsurprisingly uneven. And it's also the case that passive support for Aboriginal rights is one thing, while direct participation in activist campaigns, you know, is something else. And it's important to acknowledge that wasn't just some organic process. It took the intervention both of Aboriginal people themselves and their struggles, and of left-wing activists making arguments for why the workers' movement should take up these struggles. But still, this history of solidarity, I think, is a pretty big key piece of evidence against the settler colonial theory argument. The problem with the settler colonial theory argument is it can't explain why non-Aboriginal workers have supported these struggles. And in fact, it generally suffers from a lack of historical analysis or a very one-sided comparison between very different situations. For instance, settler colonial theorists often compare the relationship between Aboriginal people and workers in Australia to that in Israel, between the Israeli and Palestinian populations, to argue that Australian workers here benefit from Indigenous oppression. But this ignores really big differences between the two cases. In Israel, there's compulsory military service, so significant sections of the Israeli working class actually have been involved in, like, violent oppression of Palestinians, which is, you know, not the case in Australia. There's also a sizable minority of people in Israel who are the Zionist, you know, settlers actually on the land fighting for control with the Palestinians. Again, there's no comparable section of Australian society involved in such a thing. The question of the expansion of the Zionist project and the subjugation of the Palestinians is the major question of Israeli politics and really shapes everything. And even most of what goes for a progressive kind of left within Israel either supports the oppression of Palestinians or is, you know, not very principally opposed to that oppression. By contrast, there's no real equivalent to the settler Zionist population amongst the Australian working class. And while some racist workers have acted in terrible ways towards Aboriginal people, and many others are simply indifferent to, you know, the seriousness of racism and the plight of Aboriginal people, the vast majority of the working class has not been involved in violent conflicts with Aboriginal people over control over their land. And so that obviously shapes, you know, people's consciousness and understand these things and the possibility of anti-racist solidarity. The settler colonial argument that non-Aboriginal workers and their bosses are simply fighting over the spoils they've stolen from Aboriginal people also doesn't really capture the actual dynamics of class struggle and exploitation in Australia. The capitalist society that's been created here was based on the dispossessed lands of Aboriginal people and filled with exploitation, oppression, and cruelty. And it's not in the material interests of the non-Aboriginal working class that the society continues as it currently exists. Rather, it's in its interest to build a radically different one based upon workers' democracy, economic planning, and genuine equality. Indeed, when working class struggle has been most intense and most generalized, the tendency has been for more solidarity and joint action with oppressed groups. So if workers' struggle is simply about trying to get more of the benefits that settler society overall has taken from Aboriginal people, then workers have become more hostile to Aboriginal people as they're trying to fight for more, whereas actually the tendency is the opposite. As they've become more confident to fight for their rights, to demand more from society, they've become more open to the struggles of Aboriginal people and to linking their struggles together. In the Australian context, then, settler colonial theory, I think, is very inaccurate because it presents Indigenous oppression in Australia today as being caused by an ongoing colonial process rather than capitalist society. And this leads settler colonial theorists to place the blame of all anti-Aboriginal racism on the entirety of settler society, including non-Aboriginal workers. Settler colonial theorists argue that the mass of workers in Australia are essentially akin to the settler population in Israel, and this ignores the history of non-Aboriginal workers supporting the struggles of Indigenous people in Australia, and I think ends up, at the very least, downplaying, if not absolving, the blame that should be portioned towards the Australian ruling class in capitalism for their role in continuing the oppression of Aboriginal people. So that's Australia. When it comes to Israel and Palestine, though, settler colonial theory can seem much more useful and applicable. After all, Israel most definitely is a settler colonial state, and it is involved in an ongoing process of colonization in which it seeks to dispossess the Palestinian population of their remaining control over sections of Gaza and the West Bank. And while you can debate exactly why this is the case, it is clear that orienting towards the Israeli working class as some key ally for Palestinian liberation is a pretty dead-end strategy, very unlikely to bear fruit. And there's a long tradition of radicals and socialists, you know, arguing that Israel is a settler colonial state to rebut those who want to try and defend Israel from accusations of imperialism, racism, and colonialism. However, there are, I think, still important limitations to the settler colonial theory analysis, even the case of Israel and Palestine. And here, I think we have to distinguish between the political position that Israel is a settler colonial state, a position that lots of people from different political positions can agree with. You know, we're revolutionary Marxists, we agree with that. You know, there's Arab nationalists agree with that. There's Stalinists, there's anarchists, there's liberal anti-Zionists. There's people from a whole range of political positions who can see what Israel is as a settler colonial state. But that is, I think, different to the broader political framework of settler colonial theory, which goes well beyond simply saying that Israel is a settler colonial state. It has a whole explanation for why that's the case, which I think is very wrong. And so while it's absolutely correct to distinguish between the oppressors and the oppressed, this is only the beginning of a serious analysis of the oppression of the Palestinians. And unfortunately, the narrow framing of the question by settler colonial theorists I think often stops here, leaving a whole lot of essential questions unanswered. And worse still, this framework is often a barrier to grappling with a deeper understanding of how class and capitalism shapes Israel's oppression of the Palestinians and the broader politics of imperialism in the Middle East. So a bit on the Middle East. Control over the Middle East has long been an important project of various imperialist nations due to the region's central role in both global trade routes and the production of raw materials, particularly oil in the 20th century. The geopolitical structure of the modern region is largely the product of various partition plans and occupations by the British and French empires during the 20th century, who sought to mould the region to suit their own interests. Following the decline of the European powers, the United States took a leading role in defending and entrenching the interests of Western capitalism in the region. You know, from forging alliances with the Gulf states and Israel to providing providing Israel military funding and diplomatic support to invading countries like Afghanistan and Iraq, which was seen as bucking Western control. And this is a historic context for both the creation of the Israeli state, the role it has played in the region, and the continued support it has obtained from capitalist governments around the world. So understanding and opposing colonialism and imperialism are, of course, an important, very important part of grasping the history and present nature of the oppression of the Palestinians and the situation in the Middle East more generally. However, this is not the whole picture. While the Middle East has long been dominated by the interests of imperialist powers residing outside the region, it would be wrong to present the situation as simply one of a homogeneous, undifferentiated Middle East dominated by foreign imperialism. As the Marxist writer Adam Hanin has argued, capitalist class formation in the Middle East has become increasingly tied to the ebbs and flows of accumulation on a global scale. And this has led to the creation of a domestic Arab capitalist class internal to the Middle East that is to a great extent aligned with the interests of global imperialist capitalism. Even before Western imperialism established a foothold in the region, the Middle East was dominated by class societies with long-established structures of inequality and exploitation. And since then, capitalism has developed throughout the region, creating powerful and wealthy ruling classes and states, and a mass of exploited workers. The modern Middle East, then, is not simply dominated by imperialism. A system, at any rate, in which Middle Eastern ruling classes are complicit in, is also sharply divided by class. Challenging the class structure of the region and the capitalist system that underlies it must then be a central part of any movement seeking to combat imperialism in the Middle East. And it's precisely on this point that settler colonial theorists fall short, because they treat colonialism as a discrete factor that should be analysed primarily on its own terms. These theorists cannot accurately explain the roots of imperialism, and they have little appreciation of the role that class and capitalism play in the region. So Patrick Wolfe, I mentioned earlier, presents settler colonialism as essentially a self-perpetuating political system in which settler societies are driven by a logic of elimination due to their desire for unrestricted control over land. Now, every now and again, Wolfe kind of mentions capitalism, like uses the word, but he spends very little time looking at the material interests underlying this desire for land, but rather focuses on its various ideological and cultural manifestations. And as many critics have noted, Wolfe has created a highly rigid and really abstract model of colonialism, in which settler colonies, as distinct from franchise colonies, had no interest in the indigenous populations, bar wiping them off the face of the earth. A pretty simplistic picture that doesn't fit with the concrete reality of many settler colonial states across history and around the world. Now, in response to criticisms that they ignore the material aspects of colonialism, some settler colonial theorists have tried to relate their analysis to capitalism. but they can only do so by significantly distorting what the capitalist system is and how it works in order to make it fit into their pretty inaccurate understanding of colonialism. So Veracini, who I mentioned earlier, draws upon the economist David Harvey to argue that capitalism is defined by a constant and never-ending process of what he calls accumulation by dispossession or perpetual primitive accumulation. And by this, he means that what drives capitalism is the system's need to steal land, resources, and wealth by dispossession, forth, and theft. And this then is supposedly the connection between settler colonialism and capitalism. Settler colonies like Israel are simply the vanguard of this general process of dispossession. Its most kind of undiluted form is the way he also puts it. For Veracini, settler colonialism even comes to fundamentally define the modern world, well beyond the settler colonies. So the current workings of the financial institutions, the property market, the expansion of fossil fuels are all said to be expressions of settler colonialism. And, you know, in some of his later books, he's gone a bit overboard, perhaps, where he argues, like, the whole world is a settler colony. It's kind of like the logic of this position. But this is very different to how, you know, Marxists have traditionally understood capitalism. Marx argued that what was at the core of the system was the exploitation of workers by bosses, and it was this and only this that creates the huge amounts of surplus wealth that the ruling class uses to enrich themselves and create the whole modern industrial capitalist economy on a scale previously impossible. As the exploitation of the working class and the competition between bosses for control over this wealth, that defines capitalism as a system. And it's on this bedrock that the capitalist state system was constructed to ensure the continued exploitation of labor power, to regulate the stability of capitalist society, and as a vehicle for which geopolitical competition between imperialist powers could play out. Our dispossession, military conquest, and outright theft most definitely occur and have occurred throughout the history of capitalism, but they happen with this broader context of the dynamics of capitalist society. They're not the driving feature of it. The settler colonial theory view of capitalism is driven by this primitive accumulation, I think ends up echoing traditional liberal and reformist critiques of capitalism that see the problem of the system as due to its predatory nature, that, you know, kind of breaks the rules or legal norms rather than the production of surplus value through the exploitation of workers. So it's not unsurprising then that settler colonial theorists don't appreciate the importance of how class and capitalism underpin and shape imperialism, colonialism, and racism. In particular, they fail to grasp how capitalism, due to its drive to gain profits out of the exploitation of workers, also creates a working class with the potential power to challenge its rule. And this is something that would not occur if capitalism was simply stripping the Middle East out of its resources and leaving nothing behind but a network of military bases. Now, of course, economic development in the region has not been some, you know, linear, you know, progressive process. Rather, it's been marked by the intervention of powerful imperialist states who have sought to shape the region and its economic structures for their own benefit, as well as the emergence of domestic capitalism, but it definitely has been a feature. So that's probably all a bit, you know, theoretical or whatever. Let's take a closer look at how settler colonial theory looks at the nature of Israeli society and the oppression of Palestinians to see kind of more concretely the pitfalls of their approach. The origins of the Israeli state are commonly portrayed by settler colonial theorists as lying in the Jewish settlers making a pact with the West to serve its interests in the region, and the process transforming themselves into a white population. And I think this is a pretty reductive understanding of the origins of Israel on a number of levels. First of all, it places the ideological particularities of the Zionist movement and its relationship with the West as a primary factor in the creation of Israel. And this way, it downplays the essentially broader context in which the Zionist movement was empowered to found their state, the global imperialist system, and in particular, the role of British imperialism. It also overlooks the fact that the British government only supported the establishment of Israel because it was in the interest of the British capitalist class to do so, not the undifferentiated population of the Western world. Most of all, I had no say in the matter at any rate. Secondly, while Zionism did ultimately win hegemony over the Jewish settler population in Mandate Palestine, the drive to create a Zionist state ruled over by a capitalist class was in the interest of the elite of the settler population, not, I'd argue, the mass of the Jewish working class. By presenting Zionism as in the interest of the entire Jewish population, anti-colonial theorists ironically end up accommodating to the central tenet of the Zionist movement, that Zionism is the organic and natural ideology of a homogeneous Jewish nation. The argument that Jewish settlers transform themselves into a white population, that Israel is an example of white supremacy, is also, I think, dubious. It's true that there are white nationalists like Richard Spencer who champion Israel, and there's certain similarities in how Zionism racializes the Arab world with racism in Western countries. And there's discrimination within Israel itself against Jews from non-white backgrounds. However, as the Jewish anti-Zionist historian Tony Greenstein argues, the major division within Israeli society is not between black and white, but between Jewish and non-Jewish, and particular Israeli Jewish and Palestinians. The law of return allows Jews of any colour to immigrate to Israel anytime they want. This is not a right which non-Jews, black or white, possess. Only Jews can be nationals in Israel, and some 93% of Israeli land is Jewish national land, from which non-Jews are legally barred from owning. Of course, the best land in Israel is reserved for particular sections of the Jewish population. So yes, Zionism is certainly tainted by white supremacy, but this is a secondary, not primary feature of its society. The idea that Jewish settlers became white and that Israel is a white supremacist state, I think, is linked to some of the problems with the broader politics of identity politics, which is deeply embedded within settler colonial theory. It flows from the idea that imperialism, racism, and colonialism are products of whiteness and Western culture, rather than something pursued by numerous capitalist states and nationalist movements from a variety of different cultural backgrounds. After all, should we argue that Hindu nationalists in Modi's India have become white because they organise violent and racist attacks against Muslims and other minorities? It's true that these attacks have historical roots in the imperialist strategies of the old British Raj, but they continue today because of the political dynamics of contemporary Hindu nationalism. And the reality is that violent oppression is something that all sorts of capitalist states, political parties, and movements can participate in. And as capitalist development is spread across the world, including into the global south, more and more non-Western countries have created violent and oppressive capitalist states. And this is what can give the kind of appearance that they've become white. Finally, the settler colonial theory narrative downplays the class divisions within the Palestinian population itself and how these facilitated the rise of the Zionist state. It was absentee Palestinian landlords who sold large tracts of their land to the Zionist organizations, which helped them to gain a substantial foothold in the region. When Palestinian peasants and workers erupted into protests against the attacks of the Zionist movement, it was the Palestinian elites who held back these struggles, instead placing their hopes in negotiations with the British government. Ultimately, this led to a series of tragic defeats for the Palestinians that paved the way for the victory of the Zionist forces in 1948. Then after the Nakba, Arab ruling classes treated the mass of poor Palestinian refugees disgracefully, shunting them away in refugee camps. But it was a very different story for the elite of Palestinian society, who were able to carve out a position themselves within Arab states as successful business owners and professionals. Another example of the pitfalls of the settler colonial framework is the idea that the reason that Western countries like Australia, the United States, Canada, New Zealand, and so forth support Israel is because of their common heritage as settler colonial states. As the Jewish Voice for Peace Deputy Director, Ceci Saratsky, puts it, the special relationship between Israel and the United States is rooted in our common national narratives and our founding mythologies. But I think this can't explain why governments from countries that have suffered from colonialism, such as Modi's administration in India or the Kenyan government, are such strong supporters of Israel. And even in the case of the United States and Australia, their shared history of settler colonialism, I think, has very little to do with the contemporary support for Israel. The governments of Israel, of the US and Australia, support Israel because it's in the interests of their ruling classes to do so. They want to enforce their dominance over the global capitalist system by strengthening their hold over one of the key pillars of Western imperialism in the Middle East. You know, if for some reason it was no longer in their imperialist interest to support Israel, then the ruling classes of these countries wouldn't do so, no matter what shared history they might have. Yeah, it's not going to happen, but it's, theoretically. This is a clear example, I think, of how the constant historical analogies of settler colonial theorists end up presenting a distorted picture of how the world really works. It's also another example of how they downplay the importance of understanding the dynamics of global capitalism and imperialism because of their narrow focus on what they think colonialism is. The argument that Western support for Israel is based on the common heritage of settler colonies also often goes along with the idea that there's a group of nations that are leading an anti-colonial struggle against Israel, such as South Africa, Ireland, one or another of the Arab states, particularly those outside the Western camp, such as Iran and Syria, and some influenced by more hardened Stalinist politics champion China or Russia as the savior of the Palestinians. And this is based upon an extremely shallow and idolized picture of these nations and a misunderstanding of the nature of modern imperialism. So, for example, Matt Kennard, who's a left-wing journalist in Ireland, has argued that not only is solidarity of the Palestinians woven into the fabric of Sinn Féin, which is the Irish Nationalist Party, but he argues that every political party in the Republic of Ireland supports Palestinian liberation. Now, this is definitely not true. While support for Palestine, you know, is very popular amongst the people of Ireland for all sorts of reasons, socialists there have rightfully accused the government of, in their words, paddy washing genocide. As they point out, the Irish government has refused to expel the Israeli ambassador, even though like their parliament voted for it, the government said no. And they didn't support South Africa's case in the International Court of Justice, actually. Sinn Féin is rhetorically more Palestine, that's true, and there's considerable support for the issue amongst their party's membership. However, the pro-capitalist core and leadership of this party do not have any genuine commitment to fighting its imperialism in the Middle East or anywhere else. So when Joe Biden visited Ireland in 2023, for instance, the leader of Sinn Féin ruled out talking to him about Palestine, saying she wanted to focus on only Ireland particular issues. Then in October 2024, 3 weeks after Israel's attack on Gaza had been going on, Sinn Féin hailed the arrival of the US Special Envoy to Northern Ireland, Joe Kennedy III. And one Irish socialist, I think, explained well the situation. He said, "They wined and dined with him at Stormont and with city councillors in Belfast City Hall. They got him multiple photo ops across the north and defiantly trumpeted his presence across the country. While thousands remained under the genocide's rubble, they didn't utter a peep about the US backing of the Israeli murder machine, much less challenge it. Joe Biden was never named publicly, and his main man in the North, Joe Kennedy, was given a hero's welcome when he should have been shunned as a Zionist villain." Now, the government of South Africa has also attracted a lot of support from pro-Palestine activists when it brought Israel before the International Criminal Court on the charge of genocide. However, we should be clear that South Africa is not leading an alliance of anti-colonial states in the struggle against imperialism. It itself is a regional capitalist power that seeks to project its influence across Africa while shooting down striking workers and building strong economic ties with the West. And even on the question of Israel, there's a lot of hypocrisy in the South African government's positioning. So in 2021, for instance, trade between South Africa and Israel was valued at almost $300 million, which is a third of all trade between sub-Saharan Africa and Israel. In 2022, 53% of South African coal went to Israel, as did a quarter of its diamonds. And despite significant public pressure, South African companies have refused to cut economic ties with Israel since the outbreak of the recent war in October last year. And the president of South Africa defied a parliamentary vote to expel the Israeli ambassador a few months ago. And in fact, it's quite notable that to the extent there has been economic ties cut between Israel and South Africa, it's not South Africa doing the cutting, it's Israel. So Israel's got a bunch of ties, you know, to punish South Africa for taking it to the court, while South Africa has, you know, pleaded and begged for them not to do so. Settler colonial theory also significantly downplays, if not totally ignores, the class dynamics within Palestinian society. I'm going to, you know, notice before in terms of the lead up to Nakba in 1948. Since the Nakba, class divisions amongst the Palestinians have continued to be an important issue. The hundreds of thousands of Palestinians expelled from the region were integrated into the class structures within the surrounding Arab states, which, if anything, exaggerated the inequality that was already existing amongst Palestinians. Wealthier Palestinians were more insulated from the worst effects of the expulsion. And to give an idea, by the 1960s, there were hundreds of Palestinian millionaires throughout the Gulf states. For the 80% of Palestinian refugees from the poorer sections, though, who are former peasants and unskilled workers, they were viewed as an unwelcome and potentially rebellious visitor by the Arab governments, and they often formed a particularly radical section of the working class in many countries. And it's these class divisions that lay behind many of the political debates that took place within the Palestinian national movement throughout the 20th century. The whole concept that they should look towards Arab states for support didn't come out of nowhere or just reflect the fact that, you know, thought about the issue seriously or something. It reflected the fact that the upper sections of the Palestinian population were deeply connected materially to the Arab regimes. Now, Patrick Wolf has defended the absence of any discussion about class divisions within nationally oppressed groups such as the Palestinians. And he argues, "I've been often accused of this, but not once by an indigenous person." The Tunisian writer, Max Agi, is indigenous anyway, has responded to this. And he argues that native peoples do not speak with one voice. The class character of national liberation movements or their antagonists or half-hearted supporters are totally absent in Patrick Wolf's writings. Class conflicts riddle populations. Some are keen to preserve the occupation and colonialism. For some, elimination means enrichment through settler capitalist domination and the stabilization of neo-colonial domination in the West Bank, while for others, displacement has meant immiseration in the Gaza Strip. Now, some anti-colonial theorists can acknowledge divisions within national movements, but they often see elite layers within them as simply sellouts, putting their own narrow interests above that of the national movement as a whole, rather than seeing them as a class pursuing their own class interests. And they often underestimate the problem at all sorts of kind of middling layers within these movements as well. And this echoes the political framework of Arab nationalists and the Stalinist left, who drew a distinction between sections of the Arab elite or particular leaders or certain governments who had become pawns of imperialism on the one hand, and on the other, those that they called the patriotic bourgeoisie and the supposed anti-imperialist states. However, as Adam Hanin argues, it makes little sense to identify a national bourgeoisie whose interests are somehow counterposed to those of large international or regional capital. And it's a fantasy to hold out the possibility of convincing a patriotic bourgeoisie to act in the interests of the majority. These capitalist classes are part of the problem, not the solution. So, to come to a conclusion, the politics of settler colonial theory are not merely ill thought out ideas. If taken seriously as a guide to action, they would have a disastrous impact on building a movement that can actually challenge racism, imperialism, and capitalism in the long run. In South Africa, the theory that Africans suffered from internal colonization was developed by intellectuals in the South African Communist Party, and they used the theory to justify the political strategy of the African National Congress, which sought to narrow the radicalism of African workers around a program to simply replace the apartheid regime with a new capitalist government controlled by a black elite. In the United States, black power activist Stokely Carmichael and the political scientist Charles V. Hamilton used the theory that African Americans were a colony within the US to argue for building up a black political power bloc. And this ultimately primarily benefited the layer of black mayors, congressmen, and police chiefs who were elected to supposedly decolonize urban spaces. And here in Australia as well, a lot of the anti-colonial rhetoric is used to argue for, you know, more Aboriginal-owned businesses, NGOs, and government bureaucracies, rather than any genuine struggle against racism, let alone capitalism. Throughout the 20th century, we saw anti-colonial movements win across Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. And while socialists celebrated the end of direct colonial rule, we need to be clear that in none of these cases did anti-colonial revolutions lead to societies based on equality and justice. Instead, new capitalist states were created with continued exploitation and oppression the result. Ironically, I think the classless politics of settler colonial theory actually has a class basis. It represents the interests of all those social layers, middle-class intellectuals, state bureaucrats, and aspiring politicians from oppressed backgrounds who might oppose racism or war or a particular oppression, but don't want the capitalist system to end. Instead, they want a new nation state or business or bureaucracy which they or someone from their background are in control. Now, there's left-wing people who adopt the settler colonial theory framework, but would consider themselves fighting for something a lot more radical than the examples I've raised above. But the problem is that the logic of settler colonial theory inevitably leads towards pro-capitalist so-called solutions to the issues of racism and imperialism. Its very framing reinforces the idea that the key division in the world is between different national groups rather than classes. And the problems of the world are due to something external to capitalism rather than something to do with the nature of the system itself. Many of the people protesting for Palestine today are doing so, at least in part, because of these settler colonial theory ideas. But to begin to build the kinds of organizations we need to actually defeat racism, capitalism, and imperialism, then we need as many people as possible to go beyond the limits of these ideas. Throughout the 20th and 21st century, we've had all sorts of very radical, even revolutionary-sounding anti-racist and anti-imperialist theories. We've had, you know, racial capitalism, revolutionary black nationalism, dependency theory, third worldism, Guevarism, and so forth. But when put into practice, they ended in disaster. Settler colonial theories' uncritical championing of indigenous nationalist movements echo many of the problems of third worldism that influenced much of the radical left in the second half of the 20th century. So faced with another century of brutal wars and vicious oppression, we need clear Marxist politics that emphasizes the necessity of confronting the underlying structures of capitalism for the immense potential power of the working class.